We're talking about chronic pain, head, neck, back pain. It's all here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. A new study in India looked at the association between smartphone use and new headaches or increased severity. It found that people who use their smartphones frequently and have headaches or migraines also tend to need more meds than people with headaches who do not have smartphones. But the study, of course, can't prove that it's a smartphone that makes your headache worse. So do you suffer from cluster headaches or migraines? Have bad headaches caused you to miss work? Do you take over-the-counter meds for your headaches? What works? We're at 800-642-1234 through the hour. Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed is the medical director of UW Health Pain Services and Pain Management Clinic. Dr. Al, as you prefer to be called, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me again.
So you treat many patients with chronic pain, pain from injuries and accidents, other ailments. How does chronic pain impact our lives? How does it manifest in other ways?
So chronic pain starts just with the pain itself, but then it becomes a whole dilemma of other comorbidities. Patients in pain start not socializing, not being involved in family events, and being non-productive, not being able to go to work, which can lead to an anxiety depression, which further, you know, take the patient to be more home, gain weight, and the pain just gets worse, and then it gets in a cycle of like one thing after another that can be very, very incapacitating.
So if you're just say, I'm going to just stay in this dark room or stay at home and flat on my bed, and then all of a sudden that can trigger so many more issues.
Correct. And over the years, chronic pain becomes sometimes not really the issue. It becoming all the other things that are becoming really the issue.
How does it change the things we do physically or even socially?
Think about, the common scenario of having severe knee pain. So patients can't walk, can't exercise. They will sit in the recliner all day long, then start gaining more weight, and then putting more weight on the knee, the pain will get worse. And then with missing all kind of events in life, you know, troubles at work, troubles at marriage, troubles with family, start developing depression, and starting going on too many medications now for pain, depression, maybe obesity. And it's just a slippery slope that we always advise our patients, you have just to stop the process and get back your life.
When is a time to see a physician about the pain?
So whenever the patient, try things over the counter, things are not working, beyond being tolerated. Or on the other side, if it's like severe pain at the start that's causing major problems like leg weakness, loss of sensation. So anything like really either intolerable or like concerning, they should see a pain physician.
Do physicians have a guarded response to pain in terms of believing what the patient is saying about how intense that pain is?
That's a very, very good question. And that's one of the major problems that can make pain physicians avoid seeking medical care. But we, as trained in pain medicine, we believe all our patients. We believe they have the pain because it's something that's hard to measure. We have to believe our patients, and we do believe them. And then there are a lot of things we can do to see where it's coming from, like doing images or doing physical exam, and so we can see a source for pain.
That scale from 1 to 10 with the really frown and the sweat coming off and the happy face. I mean, is that, have we moved beyond that 1 to 10 scale of measuring pain?
Completely. So the 0 to 10 scale is not very accurate, very precise, because it's very subjective. And now we use more functional questionnaires that can measure multiple aspects. Measuring the medication use, the physical activity, social activities, because these are all measures of well-being and pain control.
We're talking with Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed, the medical director of UW Health Pain Services and Pain Management Clinic. You can join in with your questions about headache pain. Do you suffer from cluster headaches or migraines? Are your headaches becoming more frequent? What do you do about the pain? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So with headaches, they're quite common. What are the different kinds of headaches that people suffer from?
So to start the big classification, there are primary headaches and secondary headaches. So primary headaches can be a standalone illness. And that includes what you just mentioned, the cluster headache, migraine headache, tension headache. And then we come to the secondary headaches, which usually have another reason to develop, including intracranial hemorrhage, brain tumors, strokes, and any other similar condition. So these are the two big categories that underneath you will have many subcategories.
And so something that is related to a hemorrhage or perhaps a tumor, that could be a completely different issue as to why those headaches are going on.
Completely.
A recent study found that people who suffer from cluster headaches are likely to miss twice the amount of work as people who don't. You know, headaches are common. Where do these cluster headaches come from?
So headache overall developed due to abnormalities in, intracranial or slash brain structure that can transmit pain, including blood vessels, nerves, muscles. So for some reason, they increase the transmission of pain impulses, which increase cause overactivity of brain structures. Also change the chemical environment of the brain and the chemical transmitters. And all are those factors that increase just the activity of the brain and initiate the headaches.
When you do imaging, can you see that? Can you see the pain?
So it's another good question. If there is a secondary reason, yes, you might see something like the hemorrhage, the tumor, or so forth. But with those primary condition, it's usually you find nothing on images.
What are the ways people can manage headache pain? You mentioned over-the-counter medications. What do you take?
So people use non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication, you know, the acetaminophen, over-the-counter medications. And that actually for some can control the pain and the headaches. For some, it will not. That's when they need to seek help from a headache specialist or a pain specialist who's specializing in headache and start other treatments, both for can be preventive or therapeutic as the headaches occur.
What might those other paths be, those other alternatives to over-the-counter medications?
So for cluster headache, they found that when the attack happens, like oxygen can be helpful, just having an oxygen mask and a tank at home. They found it to be very effective for cluster headache specifically. And then there are other classes of medications that can be used as abortive medications, like the triptans, which is kind of the famous class, among a few other alternatives. And there are then long-term medications which are preventive being used, and these should be prescribed very delicately by the headache specialist because they can lower blood pressure and other things, but they found to be beneficial for headache.
And when you say ongoing, would this be something that would build up in the blood system and be used regularly or just when the headache comes on?
No, that's actually when you use it for long-term, that's kind of the preventive, so you use it daily. And then the abortive medications are the one to be used when the headaches happen.
How common is it to try these methods versus alternative therapies like massage or acupuncture or yoga?
Very good point. So usually when we start treating headaches or pain, we like to start with non-pharmacologic, like non-medication options first. Some of them are cognitive behavioral therapy, coping mechanisms, yoga, as you mentioned, and some patients find this very, very effective. So people usually start with this and over-the-counter medications and hopefully try to avoid just moving forward to the other alternatives.
We're exploring the causes of headache pain, how to manage it. We have UW pain medicine specialist Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed through the hour answering your questions. Are headaches becoming more frequent? Have you noticed how perhaps bad posture or repetitive motion could be contributing to your pain? Do you think excessive smartphone use or stress is an issue with your head and neck pain? How debilitating is it? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment, there's more on headaches and what to do right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are new treatments on the horizon that could be promising for the estimated 39 million Americans who suffer from migraine attacks. While migraines can occur at any age, they're most active from the teenage years through a person's 40s. And people with 15 or more migraine days per month over 3 or more months have chronic migraines. So how do you control them? When do you notice one coming on? Are there preventative things you can do to make the pain less severe? What medications have you tried? Be part of this health conversation on chronic pain. We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed is Medical Director of UW Health Pain Services and Pain Management Clinic, and he stays with us. Let's look more closely at migraines. What is a migraine?
So the migraine is one of the common types of headache that affect many Americans and many, actually, patients worldwide. And this starts, again, due to many of the pathologies we talked about and start causing severe headache that can be very, very frequent in some patients, like happen on like every other day of the week and last for several hours. And it can actually be sensed before. Some patients will get like some symptoms before the headache actually occurs. And then some of them will have even post-headache effects, which can last again for several hours. That's why the nature of the headache can be very severe and very incapacitating.
How predictable is that? Because some people sense like nausea, you know, being nauseated, or like these auras, or what might be any type of indication that a migraine is about to happen?
The first thing we ask patient is to start thinking about triggers, because some might be able to identify some triggers. So we ask them to take in their diary, like, what did they eat? What happened when the migraine happened? And some patients will find that, yes, when I did this, I got the migraine. So definitely avoiding the trigger can be a big part of treating the headaches or preventing them from happening. Then some, not all patients, will have some symptoms before, like you mentioned, the nausea and other things that happens in a mild form before the severe headache hits. And those patients can start actually the treatment as they are in that phase before actually the headache happens, so might be able to make it milder or abortive. But unfortunately for some, it just hits you hard without any warning signs.
Would the triggers be anything to do with diet, or what might triggers be?
It actually has been related to stress, diet, many other things that can, certain foods. But when I talk about diet, mentioned like something in diet regularly other than specific foods that patients take. And then those patients will come over the time, they will avoid those foods to avoid having the headaches.
What are some of the after effects of migraines?
So it can be like people can continue having the nausea and vomiting, the neurological problems that can last for a certain number of hours after the headache attack subsides.
So it really wreaks havoc on the body.
It is. I mean, if patients we see who get it like every other day or 3 times a week, I mean, you can think about it, hard to work, hard to do anything.
There's a new treatment on the horizon for headaches. It's something called radiofrequency ablation. What is that?
So that's a procedure actually close to my heart because we developed it at UW, in the size and shape it is now, where we actually target nerves around the cranium, so on the head, and we basically apply heat and sort of damage those nerves, which we found to be very efficacious for patients who have migraines and failed medication management and other measures. So basically we can desensitize the structure that are overactive, and this way we burn those nerves, I would call it, which reduce the transmission of impulses to the brain and then control the headaches.
Is the procedure topical? Do you go into the brain?
No, we work outside, like on the skull, so okay. Outside those nerves that go outside of the brain, and then we place needles to apply certain probes to apply heat to those nerves. So it's an outpatient procedure. You just do it and go home. And we actually published our results in about 4 articles so far, and there is more coming. So we have experience with hundreds of patients.
We're talking with Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed. He is Medical Director of UW Health Pain Services and Pain Management Clinic. We're talking about headaches, migraines. Have you tried alternative therapies? Have you changed your lifestyle or have addressed your diet on pain issues? How is it going? What are your headaches like? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.com. www.truckdriverscheduling.org. Let's take a call now. Adama, who is a truck driver going through Minnesota. Hi, Adama.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, doctor, what do you think about people using a cucumber when they have a headache? Most of my friends, when they talk to me about headache, I tell them to use a cucumber, to add cucumber to their diet. It seems like working for them. So what do you think about that?
So, yeah, I mean, it's I would say there is no like really significant research on the cucumber for headaches. But again, anything that works can control the headaches, either by nutrition or non-pharmacological measures, definitely should be tried and used.
What can someone do for their nutrition and their diet in order to address chronic pain, specifically headaches?
So that can actually come as a very good thread from that question, that healthy lifestyle overall, like and healthy nutrition, has been actually used to reduce a lot of the pain and headache conditions. So by avoiding, you know, inflammatory foods and focus more on foods that have antioxidants. So overall, we found this actually to be effective for several patients.
So when you say inflammatory foods, would it be high salt, high protein, like your meats?
Exactly. I mean, okay. Red meat and, you know, similar, definitely fruits, vegetables. And that could be actually the case in when Adama mentioned about just going on healthy diet can actually reduce the inflammatory mediators in the body and can improve painful conditions.
As you look at alternatives like radiofrequency ablation, at what point do you introduce alternatives to your patients who have migraines and these intense headaches?
Overall, we like to start our management for all conditions, including headache, with non-pharmacological management first, then mild medications like over-the-counter medications, and then we start going to more specialized medications for the condition. And when the patient doesn't have satisfactory results with those, that's when we start introducing interventions, and radio frequency ablation is one of them.
How long will you be following these patients who have had radio frequency ablation?
So we basically, after we do the radio frequency, we see them once or they call on the phone to see how it's working. And then we found that usually patients go for around a year, plus minus, for actually either free headache or like 70% decline in headache, sometimes with weaning down the medications. And I was just working with a patient a few weeks ago. He told I'm repeating the procedure, and she told me it's been helping her for 3 years. So it can significantly reduce the headaches for quite a good time, which can help them, you know, have no headaches, reduce the medication, and just be back to their normal life.
So if she's redoing the procedure, does it mean that those nerves act eventually come back, that they restore themselves?
Exactly. So when we burn the nerve, we do damage the fibers, but then they grow back. But it takes time to grow back and connect again again, start, you know, like the transmission of the pain impulses.
Yeah. How long does the procedure take?
It doesn't take much time, but it takes preparation for before the procedure. And then maybe I would say 20 to 30 minutes, where we get everything done. And the patients typically will feel maybe sore for a couple of days because it's a procedure. But then they start seeing the improvement by decline in headaches, decline in medication use, and overall well-being by socializing and getting back to life activities.
Let's bring in another call now. Beth is here from Pewaukee. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
What's your question?
So I was saying that it's odd because yesterday, apparently, I didn't really realize it until I called my doctor, but I had my first migraine, and I was pretty freaked out. I didn't really know what was happening or why it was happening. But I got up and had this horrible pain, like from the top of my eyelid right down to like the top of my jaw. And it felt like somebody, I sat up in bed right away and felt like somebody was sprinkling glitter like in front of me. And I sat back down and immediately got sick to my stomach. And all of a sudden I was just like, I thought I was having an aneurysm for sure. Cause my neighbor had one.
Oh dear.
And I thought I was dying. So that was the first time it ever happened to me. So now I'm not quite sure. I mean, I'll make it. I have an appointment with my doctor, but I don't know what triggered it. I have no idea.
Well, Beth, thank you for describing that. What she's saying there, have you heard things like that, those symptoms?
Yes, actually, we hear all kinds of stories when it comes to migraine headaches and how it starts. But, Beth is doing the right thing. When you have your first headache, you have to see a specialist or your primary care because, as we mentioned, it could be brain tumor. It could be, it could be like other like secondary cause. In that case, it seems more likely to be the migraine headache, the primary cause, and that's why you need to start immediately the treatment to get the condition under control.
We're talking with pain specialist Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed. His past research includes studies on the use of opioids and individual response to the drug. And we've been going to be talking about back pain here in a moment. Do you suffer from back aches? Were you in an accident that caused you to have chronic back pain? What medications help alleviate the pain? There's room for you, 800-642-1234. We'll talk more about back pain after this news update on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about back pain, which can be debilitating. It can sideline you from taking part in the activities of everyday life. And some of those factors, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, technology, poor diet, have all been linked to back and neck pain. Do you regularly see a back specialist or chiropractor? Have you considered surgery to try to alleviate your back pain? Have you tried yoga or meditation? Join in, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed is our guide. He's medical director of the UW Health Pain Services and Pain Management Clinic. Let's take another call now. Jamie is joining us from West Allis this morning. Hi, Jamie.
Hello. This isn't a back pain one, as I explained. I'm very sorry, but
that's okay.
I'm wondering when it goes into the radio frequency ablation. My daughter suffers from a condition called cyclic vomiting syndrome, and oftentimes if she gets a migraine headache, it creates migraine abdominal pain as well. I'm wondering if the radio frequency ablation, has been checked for abdominal migraines and if there's been any significant results.
So, yeah, if the migraines are happening like the way they are, it can be in association with GI disease. We typically do a nerve block before we do the radio frequency ablation. It's sort of like a test or a trial before we move on to the bigger procedure. So if the nerve block works, which is a simple procedure, we do it really in a few minutes in the office, and then the patient will tell us, yes, that has improved my pain. Then we know that we're targeting the right nerves, and then we move on to the radio frequency ablation. So definitely it can help if other things failed.
How young of a patient have you tried this on?
I have done it for like children, talk about teenagers mostly, as did it to the elderly, and in between headache is usually middle age population, but I have done it for children too.
Jamie, what are some of the things that you've tried with your daughter?
DHE therapy for migraines at Children's Hospital in Milwaukee here. She was on several different, I don't want to say opioid medications, but some of them were. Recently, she was taking off most of those. It's been discussed possible acupuncture, but cyclic vomiting syndrome is pretty rough, and we're kind of grasping at straws a little bit sometimes, and this seems very, very promising to me, something I haven't heard of before. And she was actually recommended one time before for the UW system, the pain management clinic.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for the call. And Jamie did bring up opioids. How are opioids used, and especially in back pain management?
So in back pain management, I'll speak first for headache. We really don't recommend them so much for headaches. But for back pain, it's opioids have their, places still in the management of chronic pain. We worry about the kind of the chronicity of the use of opioids and their side effects that can outweigh the benefits.
The addiction.
Correct. Addiction, tolerance, and misuse, and diversion. And, you know, that's why we have high number of mortality in the U.S. related to opioids. But I worry about moving from one extreme of too much opioids now to no opioids. I always say we have to adapt just somewhere in the middle where we prescribe it to the patients who really needs it in moderate doses or low doses within the CDC and state guidelines, and then monitoring them the appropriate way.
Do you feel that the physician community has swung too conservative on the use of opioids?
Completely. So, and I think we went, again, from one extreme to the other. We just need to give it to the right patient in the right dose and do the right monitoring.
How can opioids actually contribute to pain?
So there is what's called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, which basically with the chronic use of high-dose opioids over years can actually hypersensitize the pain receptors. And they found that when you actually wean down the opioids and remove them from the medication management of the patient, the pain improves.
So let's step back here on back pain. Where does the pain come from in the lower back?
So there are several structures in the low back, which include the bones, nerves, and muscles. And the pain can come from any of those structures.
And then this type of pain, do you hear from patients, is it shooting pain? What type of pain is it?
So the low back pain, sometimes if it's coming from what we call the facet joints, for example, these are little joints that connect the vertebra together. It's more localized to the low back. When it's coming from a nerve, like the compression on the nerve root, disc bulge, and all of this, that can cause shooting pain down the legs. When it comes from the sacroiliac joints, which are two big joints at the low back, this can be a pain that's aggravated, increased by sitting, and the patient will pinpoint actually the joint as they do it. And then when it comes from the muscles, you can feel stiff muscles as you do the exam, which will be also localized to a certain area of the back.
Sometimes people, you like to put either a cold pack or a hot pack on that back. What impact does that have?
So they work by many different mechanisms. And some people will like the ice pack, some will like the warm packs. It's just a common thing we like to warn our patients, particularly when they put the warm pack, sometimes they get burns because they put it there, they like it, and then they keep it for longer than it should, and we see some burning on the back. So something to be cautious about, not to use it for long durations.
So how long on and off would you suggest?
You know, the minimum they can, really. I mean, if we can put it for 20 minutes on, 20 minutes off, or just be cautious about the temperature, either cold or warm, because that's not normal and can impair the blood supply to the area and can cause harm to the skin.
What does sitting all day at your desk do to your back?
So that's definitely sitting all day long is not great, and that's why we recommend standing desks or walk around every now and then. Because just sitting, you're putting all this weight on your low back, and depending on the posture as you sit as well can impair. It's a sedentary, I would say, form. We need people to be more active and at least try to stand and sit and walk.
We're talking with Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed, the Medical Director of UW Health Pain Services and Pain Management Clinic. You can join in on your chronic pain. Do you suffer from back pain? Were you in an accident that caused a lingering back pain? Do you wake up with an aching back? How do you treat it? How do you go about your day? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So when is surgery discussed for back pain? When do you take that step?
So we try to preserve surgery as a last resort for chronic pain. So you start the non-pharmacological treatment, medications, and we do pain interventions. And when this all fails, we start discussing with the surgeon about the surgical options. The other thing, if you see immediately, again, like an acute disc bulge that's causing weakness of the leg, that's probably a surgical option right away. So that's why we have to keep a balance between when it's acute, severe, causing a neurological problem, or it's chronic and we can have time to work on it.
So you hear things like a slipped disc or some other issues with the spine. What is going on there?
The slipped disc, like it can happen, is that when... So the disc is like this cushion in between two bony vertebrae, and it can slip backward. or to one side or another and start to compressing on the spinal cord and the nerves. And that's what causes really severe pain that can require surgery to either remove portion of the disc or remove this pressure on the spinal cord or the nerves.
You can actually see the bulging in, you know, on the skin that when...
No, you just have to do an image, like MRI or so, but you do see it very clearly on the MRI.
How successful are these back pain surgeries?
Hard to tell really, but there is what we call the failed back surgical syndrome. So patients can have the surgery, but unfortunately continue to have the pain after the surgery. And that becomes more challenging to treat. That's why the surgical option is really preserved after a thorough discussion with a surgeon and knowing that this is an option that has to be like chosen by the patient.
Have we made advancements in back pain and specifically in the surgical area of trying to treat back pain?
Yes. So back pain has been always a focus because it's a main reason for disability and pain in the U.S. So there are a lot of advancement in treatment of back pain, of particularly the minimally invasive procedures that doesn't require the patient to go for large surgeries. So there is a significant number now of minimally invasive procedures that can be done, which can cause less scarring and quicker healing.
So when you say it's minimally invasive, what actually is going on?
I'll give an example when you have the slip disc we talked about. So there is now an option to do the microdiscectomy, which you can go in with scopes and just remove portions of the disc, as opposed to just making a big surgery open and just try to remove the disc. Because the more incisions you do, the more interventions you do, the more scar tissue will develop, which can cause, again, pressure on the nerve and impair healing.
And so you're talking there about a micro incision.
Correct.
Is that right? So yeah. Very, very small.
Yes, literally through like small tubes. You go in with your tools, get the part of the disc out, and just close.
We're spending the hour on pain management, back pain specifically, with Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed, who specializes in diagnosing and treating pain. Do you know someone who experiences chronic backaches? How do you support that person? Are you a physician or therapist who helps people ease their chronic pain? What techniques do you find most effective in your patients? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Send your questions to ideas@WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment. There's more conversation about chronic pain right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Healthcare spending on neck and back pain has increased every year since 1996. That's new research tracking U.S. healthcare spending out this month in JAMA. And now there are newer and more expensive treatments for back pain. Back pain can stem from a range of causes, from a mild strain to a car accident. Do you live with this pain? Still time for you. 800-642-1234. Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed is Medical Director of the UW Health Pain Services and Pain Management Clinic, and he stays with us. Let's take another call now. John is with us from Jefferson this morning. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So back in the 80s, I'm currently 62 and retired, but back in the 80s, I had a disc removed. I had two surgeries. The first time, they just took out the part that flipped. Second time, they took out the rest of it and put titanium rods in. Since then, every now and then, my back will go out where the pain is excruciating across my lower back. It doesn't go all the way down my leg, but goes into my thigh. And it, like the last time, it took 8 days to get pretty much over that. I'm just wondering if the titanium rods, in his opinion, should be removed, or is there other options for myself?
So here's my advice, John. Definitely you need to check on those rods with the spine surgeon. Just take a look, make an image, make sure they are in place, no loose screws or anything. And then if they assure you that everything is okay, then you need to be seen by a pain management specialist Because again, we work all the time on patients who had back surgery by giving, you know, medications, infusion therapy, doing interventions away from the hardware, but delivering the medication to the hardware area, causing pain relief, you know, placing spinal cord stimulator. There are all kinds of treatments for patients after surgery. But you want to make sure first by evaluated by a spine surgeon.
Do titanium rods or that hardware in the body, do they have a shelf life? Do they have some issues over time, over decades?
They can have issues, meaning, I mean, either like the healing process itself and that too much scar tissue that develop because of them can cause the pain, or they definitely anything can happen to them because the bony structure will change over time.
John, thanks for the call. Let's go to Mary now in Waupun. Hi, Mary.
Hi, yes. 7.5 years ago, I was in a car accident, and I broke my neck, my back, four places, all my ribs. I was in the UW trauma intensive care unit, and I was told at that time that I would have neuropathy in my back, and I'm 70 years old now, and it's gotten worse. So if I'm doing something like gardening or trying to do dishes or trying to cook, it's that slight angle of my back. I get intense pain, and I just have to quit. I can't do anything. And I've never done anything because I was told that it was just going to be there. Is there anything that I could do to deal with this?
So as simple as, you know, starting physical therapy and over-the-counter medications when you do, for example, gardening so you can keep going because it's very good to be active and do the activities you like. And if those simple measures do not work, yeah, sometimes I would really recommend you be seen by a pain specialist if those little measures do not work. Because you can then maybe try a few things, nothing big, that can allow you to do things you like the gardening and keep up with your back pain, you know, so you can continue to be active.
How effective is physical therapy, you know, particularly in Mary's situation here?
It's actually very effective because it does strengthen the muscles and can help the patients to avoid the wrong postures because you can do everything, you know, like if you go to the gym, some people go to the gym can hurt their back and some can benefit their back. And these are all things you learn from the physical therapists. And they are definitely, I mean, all our patients have to do physical therapy.
We're talking with Dr. Ala Abid Al-Sayed. He is Medical Director of UW Health Pain Services and Pain Management Clinic. Still time for you on your back pain, chronic pain, 800-642-1234. Let's take Tony now, who is joining us near La Crosse. Hi, Tony.
Hello.
What is your situation? Yeah, hi. What is your situation with chronic pain?
I've been dealing with it for a long time, and I used to take the tramadol to work during the day and then the codone, hydrocodone at night to sleep. And I just got so sick of the side effects that I quit taking them. But now my back is seeming to be getting worse, and my legs are starting to get where they feel like I'm not able to walk sometimes. Mm. And I was just wondering what, you know, if he had any ideas on that. And I just keep doing my stuff and live with the pain because I just didn't like the side effects of the drugs, I guess.
Yeah, very good question, Tony. And ideally, you know, we try to avoid really opioids and medication for long-term use. So there are many other options. I really encourage you to see a pain specialist. There are many alternatives to opioid, other medications. Again, we talked about the non-pharmacological management. There are very simple procedures that you can do in the office or in a surgical center, like, and just go home on the same day, which can benefit maybe you for several months. That can reduce both your consumption of opioids, but can also improve your ability to work and being active. So there are many, many options other than those medications.
We mentioned physical therapy. What about chiropractors?
So chiropractors are tried by patients and can be effective for some of them. And other modalities like the acupuncture and other things, it's just we encounter sometimes issues with insurance coverage. But definitely if patients want to try them and if they're being helpful, we ask them to continue to work with them.
Tony, thanks. Let's go to Jim now in River Falls. Hi, Jim. What's on your mind about pain issues?
Yeah, I have a question. This is his wife. I have hip tendonitis that I've had for 13 years. I did have an injection of, it was not steroids, but it was a painkiller that didn't seem to work. I'm concerned about tendon rupture with steroids. My husband was thinking laser therapy, but just wondering on your thoughts about any sort of treatment for that. I've had it quite some time, and it does get to be pretty debilitating.
Yeah, thanks for your call. It's definitely steroid injection should be tried in your case. You mentioned tendonitis and seemed there is inflammation, and steroids are very strong anti-inflammatory medications. Again, there are considerable measures that can be done, including medications, a physical therapy, steroid injection. There is even things we do beyond steroid injections if they fail that can probably help your pain. And I would like to stress on that when we treat the pain, it's very important we ask the patient go back to physical therapy immediately. So now you don't have pain. You can contribute and participate more. And this way they get better benefit from the physical therapy as opposed to the limitations patients might have if they have pain.
So you really, after the treatment starts and they're not experiencing pain, you really double down on that physical therapy aspect.
Completely. That's the main plan here.
What has changed about chronic pain management as you've seen it over the years, over the decades? What is changing about this type of medicine?
So it's a very, very important question. I would say now in pain, the change is happening every year. So you will go to a conference every year, you will find too many new technologies, new medications targeting different receptors in the work. And even if I go to a conference overseas, I'll see stuff that approved here. We're waiting on approval in the US. It's very surprisingly, very dynamic. Too many new like modalities every year. Definitely, if we compare it to the past decades, we're just it's day and night. What the number of tools and interventions and medications we have right now.
So are these pharmacological advancements? What are you seeing in these brand new things on the horizon?
There are pharmacological advancement and several medications. There are medications used in interventions, but they are not steroids or opioids. So they try to make more benign medications with less side effects for injection purpose even. And there are a lot of implantable devices like minimally invasive surgeries. And it's just, again, it's happening every year. We get more and more options, which is good news for our patients. And the thing I tell my patients, if we don't have the treatment today, please check next year. And you'll be surprised. It happens. And they come a year to follow and we tell them, yes, now we have an option for you.
Well, Dr. L, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Ala Abd Al-Sayed is Medical Director of UW Health Pain Services and Pain Management Clinic. And if you missed any part of this conversation, you can listen to it in its entirety at wpr.org/mornings. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.